to his damaged throat, then pulled it away and stared aghast at his own gore, dripping off his fingers. The killer thought he was dying, and that might make him either less or more dangerous. Simultaneously, they saw that his pistol had been kicked halfway across the library during their tussle. It was closer to him than to Ginger. Bleeding from throat and wrist, making a strange, wheezing, gurgling noise, he scrambled across the floor toward the weapon, and Ginger had no option but to get up and run. She fled from the library into the living room, hobbling more than running, slowed by the pain in her back, which pulsed through her in diminishing but still debilitating waves. She intended to leave the apartment by the front door, but then she realized there was no escape in that direction because the only exits from the public corridor were the elevator and the stairs. She could not wait for the elevator, and in the stairwell she could easily be trapped. Instead, hunched because of her aching back, she scurried crab-like across the living room, down a long hall, into the kitchen, where the swinging door softly swished shut behind her. She went directly to the utensils rack on the wall by the stove and took down a butcher's knife. She became aware that a shrill, eerie keening was issuing from her. She held her breath, cut off the sound, and got a grip on herself. The gunman did not immediately burst into the kitchen as Ginger expected. After a few seconds, she realized that she was lucky he had not yet appeared because the butcher's knife was of no use against a pistol at a distance of 10 feet. Silently cursing herself for almost having made a fatal error, she quickly and light-footedly returned to the door and took up a position to one side of it. Her back still ached, but the sharpest pain was gone. Now she was able to stand straight and flat against the wall. Her heart was pounding so loud that it seemed as if the wall against which she leaned was a drumhead, responding to her heartbeat, amplifying it until the hollow booming of atrium and ventricle must be echoing throughout the entire apartment. She held the knife low, ready to swing it up and into him in a deadly arc. However, that desperate scenario depended on his slamming through the kitchen door in a fit of hysteria and rage, reckless, crazed by the conviction that he was dying from his throat wound, bent on blind revenge. If instead he came slowly, cautiously, nudging the swinging door open inch by inch with the barrel of the gun, Ginger would be in trouble. But every second that passed without his appearance made it less likely that he would play the drama out in the way she hoped. Unless the throat wound was far worse than she had realized. In that case, he might be still in the library, bleeding to death on the Chinese carpet. She prayed. That was what had happened to him. But she knew better. He was alive. And he was coming. She could scream, and perhaps alert a neighbor who would call the police, but the gunman would not be driven off in time. He would not run until he killed her. Screaming was a waste of energy. She pressed harder against the wall, as if trying to melt into it. The swinging door, just inches from her face, riveted her, as a black snake might command the full attention of a field mouse. She was tense, poised to react to the first sign of movement, but the door remained still, maddeningly still. Where the hell was he? 5 seconds passed. 10. 20. What was he doing? The taste of blood in her mouth became more rather than less acrid as the seconds ticked past, and nausea worked its greasy fingers in her. As she had more time to consider what she had done to him in the library, she grew acutely aware of the bestiality of her actions, and she was shaken by her own potential for savagery. She had time, as well, to think about what she still intended to do to him. She had a mental image of the wide blade of the butcher's knife spearing deep into his body, and a shudder of revulsion shook her. She was not a killer. She was a healer, not merely by education, but by nature as well. She tried to stop thinking about stabbing him. It was dangerous to think too much about it, dangerous and confusing and enervating. Where was he? She could not wait any longer. Afraid that her inaction was damping the animal cunning and savage ferocity that she needed if she were to survive, uneasily certain that each passing second was somehow giving him a greater advantage, she eased to the doorway and put one hand on the edge of the door. But as she was about to pull it open a crack and peer out at the hallway and into the living room, she was chilled by the sudden feeling that he was there, inches away, on the other side of the portal, waiting for her to make the first move. Ginger hesitated, held her breath, listened. Silence. She brought her ear to the door, still could not hear anything. The handle of the knife had grown slippery in her sweaty hand. At last, she took hold of the edge of the door and cautiously pulled it inward until a half-inch gap opened. No shots rang out, so she put one eye to the crack. The gunman was not right in front of her, as she had feared, but at the far end of the hall where it met the foyer. He was just re-entering the apartment from the public corridor, pistol in hand. Evidently, he had first looked for her at the elevator and on the stairs. Not finding her, he had returned. Now, by the way he closed the door, locked it, and engaged the chain to delay her exit, it was clear that he had decided she was still in the apartment. He held his bitten hand to his bitten throat. Even at a distance, she could hear his wheezy breathing. However, he was clearly no longer panicked. Having survived this long, he was gaining confidence by the second. He had begun to realize that he would live. Moving to the edge of the foyer, he looked left toward the living room and right toward the bedroom. Then he looked straight back down the long shadowy hall. And Ginger's heart stumbled through a flurry of irregular beats as, for a moment, he seemed to be staring directly at her. But he was too far away to see that the door was being held half an inch ajar. Instead of coming straight toward her, he went into the bedroom. He moved with a quiet purposefulness that was disheartening. She let the kitchen door go shut, unhappily aware that her plan would no longer work. He was a professional, accustomed to violence, and although he was initially thrown off balance by the unexpected ferocity of her attack, he was rapidly regaining his equilibrium. By the time he searched the bedrooms and the closets in there, he would be completely cool and calculating once more. He would not come charging into the kitchen and make an easy target of himself. She had to get out of the apartment. Fast! She had no hope of reaching the front door. He might already be finished in the bedroom and on his way back into the hall. Ginger put the knife down. She reached under her sweater, pulled off her ruined bra, and dropped it on the floor. She stepped silently around the kitchen table, pulled the curtains away from the window, and looked out at the fire escape landing in front of her. Quietly, she twisted the latch. She slid up the lower sash, which unfortunately was not quiet. The wooden frame, swollen by the winter dampness, moved with a squeak and squeal and scrape. When it abruptly loosened and slid all the way up with a solid thump and a rattle of glass, she knew she had alerted the gunman. She heard him coming at a run along the hallway. She climbed hastily out of the window, onto the iron fire escape, and started down. The bitter wind lashed her, and the piercing sub-zero cold penetrated to her bones. The metal steps were crusted with ice from last night's storm, and icicles hung from the handrails. In spite of the treacherous condition of those switchback stairs, she had to descend quickly or risk a bullet in the back of her head. Repeatedly, her feet almost slipped out from under her. She could not get a secure grip on the icy railing with her ungloved hands, but it was even worse when she took hold of the bare metal, for she stuck to the frigid iron, pulling loose only by sacrificing the top layer of skin. When she was still four steps from the next landing, she heard someone curse above her, and she glanced back. Pablo Jackson's killer was coming out of the kitchen window in frantic pursuit of her. Ginger took the next step too fast, and the ice did its work. Her feet flew out from under her, and she fell over the final three steps onto the landing, crashing down on her side. reigniting the pain in her back. Her fall shattered the ice that coated the metal grid, and chunks fell through lower levels of the fire escape, making brittle music, disintegrating as they struck the steps below. In the wind's maniacal howling, the whisper of the silenced pistol was lost altogether. But Ginger saw sparks leap off the iron inches from her face, and she knew a shot had narrowly missed her. She looked up in time to see the gunman taking aim, and to see him slip and stumble down several treads. He pitched forward, and she thought he was going to fall atop her. He grabbed at the railing three times before he was able to halt his uncontrolled descent. He was sprawled on his back across several risers, clutching a step with one hand, one leg shot out into space between two of the narrow iron balusters. His other arm was hooked around a baluster, which was how he had arrested his fall. That was the hand holding the pistol, which was why he could not immediately take another shot at her. Ginger scrambled to her feet, intent upon making as rapid a descent as possible. But when she cast one last quick look at the gunman, she was arrested by the sight of the buttons on his topcoat, which were the only colorful objects in that wintry gloom, bright brass buttons, each decorated with the raised image of a lion passant, the familiar cadence mark from English heraldry. She had seen nothing special about the buttons before. They were similar to those on many sports jackets, sweaters, coats. But now her eyes fixed on them, and everything else faded away, as if only the buttons were real. Even the gabbling, hooting wind which filled the day and blustered coldly in every corner of it could not keep a grip on her awareness. The buttons. Only the buttons held her attention, and they generated in her a terror far more powerful than her fear of the gunman. "No," she said, uselessly denying what was happening to her. "The buttons. How? No. The buttons." This was the worst possible time and place to lose control of herself. "The buttons." She could not forestall the attack. For the first time in 3 weeks, Ginger was overwhelmed by a crushing, irrational terror. It made her feel small, doomed. It plunged her into a strange and lightless interior landscape through which she was compelled to run blindly. Turning from the buttons, she fled down the fire escape, and as total blackness claimed her, she knew that her reckless flight would terminate in a broken leg or fractured spine. Then, while she lay paralyzed, the killer would come to her, put the gun to her head, and blow her brains out. Darkness. Cold. When the world returned to Ginger, or she to the world, she was huddled in dead leaves and snow and shadows at the foot of a set of exterior cellar steps behind a townhouse, an unguessable distance along Newbury Street from Pablo's building. A dull pain throbbed the length of her back. Her entire right side ached. The badly abraded palm of her left hand burned. But the severe cold was the worst discomfort. A chill lanced up through her from the snow and ice in which she sat. A frost passed into her by osmosis from the concrete retaining wall against which she leaned. The raw wind rushed down the single flight of 10 steep steps, snuffling and growling like a living creature. She did not know how long she had been cowering there, but she ought to get moving or risk pneumonia. However, the gunman might be nearby, searching for her, and if she revealed herself, the chase would be on again, so she decided to wait a minute or two. She was astonished that she had clambered all the way down the ice-sheathed fire escape and had fled, by whatever roundabout route, to this hiding place without breaking her neck. Evidently, in her fugue, reduced to the miserable condition of a frightened and mindless animal, there was at least the compensation of an animal-like fleetness and sure-footedness. Like a pair of industrious morticians, the wind and cold continued to drain the warmth from her. The narrow, gray concrete stairwell increasingly resembled an unlidded sarcophagus. Ginger decided it was time to go. She rose slowly. The small backyard was deserted, as were the yards of houses on both sides. Ice-crusted snow, a few bare trees, nothing threatening. Shivering, sniffing, blinking away tears, Ginger climbed the stairs and followed a brick walkway that linked the rear of the house to the gate at the end of the small property. She intended to find her way back to Newbury Street, locate a telephone, and call the police, but as she reached the gate, that plan was abruptly forgotten. On each of the two gateposts was a wrought-iron carriage lamp with amber panes of glass. Either they'd been left burning by accident, or were activated by a solenoid that had mistaken the dreary winter morning for twilight. They were electric lamps, but had those flickering bulbs that imitated gas flames, so the lantern glass was alive with shimmering, dancing, amber light. That throbbing, yellowish luminosity made Ginger's breath catch, and she was once more pitched into a state of unreasoning panic. No, not again! But yes, yes, the mist, nothingness, gone. Colder. Her feet and hands were going numb. She was apparently on Newbury Street again. She had crawled under a parked truck. Lying in the gloom under the oil pan, she peered out from beneath her sanctuary, getting a wheel-level view of the vehicles parked on the other side of the street. Hiding. Every time she recovered from a fugue, she was hiding from something unspeakably terrifying. Today, of course, she was hiding from Pablo's killer, but what about other days? What had she been hiding from then? Even now, she was hiding not only from the gunman, but from something else that hovered tantalizingly at the edge of remembrance, something she had seen out in Nevada, something...
Miss? Hey, miss?
Ginger blinked and turned stiffly toward the voice, which came from the back of the truck. She saw a man, on his hands and knees, looking under the tailgate. For a moment she thought it was the gunman.
Miss? What's wrong?
Not the gunman. Evidently, he had given up when he couldn't find her quickly and had fled. This was someone she had never seen before, and this was one occasion when a stranger's face was welcome. He said,
"What the hell are you doing under there?"
Ginger was filled with self-pity. She realized how she had looked, running crazily through the neighborhood like some demented freak. All dignity had been stolen from her. She squirmed toward the man who had spoken to her, grasped the gloved hand he offered, and allowed him to help her slide out from beneath the truck, which proved to be a Mayflower Moving Company van. The rear doors were open. She glanced inside and saw boxes. Furniture. The guy who had pulled her out was young, brawny, and dressed in quilted thermal coveralls with the Mayflower logo stitched across the chest.
"What's going on?" he asked. "Who are you hiding from, lady?"
As the Mayflower man spoke, Ginger noticed a policeman standing in the middle of the intersection half a block away, directing traffic where a signal light had failed. She ran toward him. The Mayflower man called after her. She was surprised she could run at all. She felt as if she were a creature constructed of nothing but aches and pains and chills, yet she ran with a dreamy effortlessness into the shrieking wind. The gutters were full of icy slush, but the street itself was relatively dry and calcimine streaked with de-icing compounds. Dodging out of the way of a couple of oncoming cars, she even found the strength to call out to the cop as she drew near him.
"There's been a man killed! Murder! You've got to come! Murder!"
Then, when he started toward her with a look of concern on his broad Irish face, she saw the shiny brass buttons on his heavy winter-weight uniform coat, and all was lost again. They were not exactly like the buttons on the leather topcoat the killer had been wearing. They were not decorated with a lion passant, but with some other raised figure. But one glimpse sent her thoughts flashing toward remembrance of buttons she had seen then, during the mysterious events at the Tranquility Motel. Some forbidden recollection began to surface, and that pulled the Azrael trigger. As she lost control and ran off into her private darkness, the last thing she heard was her own pathetic cry of despair. Coldest. That morning, at least for Ginger Weiss, Boston was the coldest place on earth. Bitter, polar, piercing, marrow-freezing, the January day induced a glaciation of the spirit as well as the flesh. When the fugue receded, she was sitting on the ground in ice and snow. Her hands and feet were numb, stiff. Her lips were chapped and cracked. This time, she had taken refuge in the narrow space between a row of well-manicured bushes and a brick building, in a shadowy corner where the angled wall of a bay-windowed tower met a flat portion of the main facade, the former Hotel Agassiz, where Pablo had his apartment, where he had been killed. She had come nearly full circle. She heard someone approaching. Between the hoary branches of the snow-dressed and ice-laced shrubs, she saw someone climbing over the low wrought-iron fence that separated the front lawn from the sidewalk. She did not see the person himself, merely his booted feet, legs clad in blue trousers and the flaps of a long, heavy navy blue coat, but as he came across the narrow strip of lawn toward the shrubbery, she knew who he was, the traffic cop from whom she had turned and run. Fearing yet another seizure at the sight of his coat buttons, Ginger closed her eyes. Perhaps irreversible psychological damage was a side effect of the brainwashing she had undergone, an inevitable result of the tremendous and constant stress generated by the artificially repressed memories struggling mightily to make themselves known. Even if she could find another hypnotist to do for her what Pablo had done, perhaps there was no way the block could be broken or the pressure relieved, in which case she was destined to deteriorate further. If she was stricken by three fugues in one morning, what was to prevent three more in the next hour? The policeman's boots crunched noisily through the sleet-skinned snow. He stopped in front of her. She heard him pressing against the low bushes and parting them to look into her hiding place.
"Miss? Hey, what's wrong? What were you shouting about murder? Miss?"
Maybe she would fall into a fugue and remain there forever.
"Oh, now, what are you crying about?" the cop said sympathetically. "Darling, I can't help you if you won't tell me what's wrong."
She would not be the daughter of Jacob Weiss if she failed to respond warmly and eagerly to the slightest sign of kindness in others, and the policeman's concern finally affected her. She opened her eyes and looked up at the topmost brass button on his coat. The sight of it did not bring the hateful darkness upon her. But that meant nothing, for the ophthalmoscope, black gloves, and other triggering items had not affected her later when she had forced herself to confront them again. In a crackle of ice, the cop pushed between the bushes. She said,
"They've killed Pablo. They murdered Pablo."
And as she spoke those words, her distress over her condition was made worse by a rush of guilt. The 6th of January would forever be a black day in her life. Pablo was dead because he tried to help her. Such a very cold day. 5. On the Road. Monday morning, the 6th of January, Dom Corvaces cruised his old Portland neighborhood in a rented Chevrolet, trying to recapture the mood he had been in when he had left Oregon for Mountain View, Utah, more than 18 months ago. The rain, as heavy as any he had ever seen, had stopped near dawn. Now the sky, though still cloudy from horizon to horizon, was a particularly powdery, dry-looking shade of gray, like a burnt field, as if there had been a fire behind the clouds that had forced out all that precipitation. He drove through the university campus, stopping repeatedly to let the familiar scene stir feelings and attitudes of times past. He parked across the street from the apartment where he had lived, and as he stared up at the windows, he tried to recall the man he had been then. He was surprised at how difficult it was to recollect the timidity with which that other Dom Corvaces had viewed life. Though he could bring to mind the way he had been, there was no intimacy or poignancy to those memories. He could see those old days again, but he could not feel them, which seemed to indicate that he could never be that old Dom again, regardless of how much he feared the possibility. He was convinced that he had seen something terrible on the road the summer before last, and that something monstrous had been done to him. But that conviction generated both a mystery and a contradiction. The mystery was that the event had wrought in him an undeniably positive change. How could an experience fraught with pain and terror affect a beneficial change in his outlook? The contradiction was that, in spite of the beneficial effect on his personality, the event filled his dreams with horror. How could his ordeal have been both terrifying and positive, both horrible and uplifting at the same time? The answer, if it could be found, was not here in Portland, but out on the highway. He started the engine, put the Chevy in gear, pulled away from his old apartment building, and went looking for trouble. The most direct route from Portland to Mountain View began with Interstate 80 north. But as he had done 19 months ago, Dom took a more roundabout trail, heading south on Interstate 5. That special summer, he had scheduled a layover in Reno for a few days to do some research for a series of short stories about gambling, so the less direct route had been necessary. Now, in his rented Chevy, he followed the familiar highway, keeping his speed down to 50, even as low as 40 on the steeper hills, for he had been pulling a U-Haul trailer that last day in June, and he had not made good time. And, as before, he stopped for lunch in Eugene. Hoping to spot something that would goose his memory and provide a link with the mysterious events of the previous trip, Dom looked over the small towns that he passed. However, he saw nothing that made him uneasy, and nothing bad happened all the way to Grant's Pass, where he arrived shortly before 6 o'clock that evening, right on schedule. He stayed in the motel where he had been a guest 18 months ago. He remembered the number of the room, 10, because it was near the soft drink and ice machines, which had been the source of irritating noises half the night. It was unoccupied, and he took it, vaguely explaining to the clerk that it had sentimental associations for him. He ate at the same restaurant across the road from the motel. He was seeking satori, which was a Zen word meaning sudden enlightenment, a profound revelation. But enlightenment eluded him. All day he had used the rearview mirror, hoping to spot a tail. During dinner he surreptitiously watched the other customers, but if he was being followed his tail was masterful, invisible. At 9 o'clock, rather than use the telephone in his room, he walked to a nearby service station payphone. With his credit card, he placed a call to the number of another payphone in Laguna Beach. By prearrangement, Parker Fane was waiting there with a report on the mail that he had collected for Dom earlier in the day. There was little chance that either of their phones was tapped. However, after receiving those two disturbing Polaroid snapshots, Dom had decided, and Parker had agreed, that in this case, prudence and paranoia were synonymous.
"Bills," Parker said. "Advertisements. No more strange messages and no more Polaroids. How's it going at your end?"
"Nothing so far," Dom said, leaning wearily against the plexiglass and aluminum wall of the phone booth.
"Didn't sleep well last night."
"But you didn't go for a walk?"
"Didn't even get one knot untied. Had a nightmare, though. The moon, again."
"Anybody follow you to that payphone?"
"Not unless he was thin as a dime and a master of camouflage," Parker said.
"So you can call me here again tomorrow night and not have to worry that they've tapped the line."
"We sound like two madmen," Dom said.
"I'm kind of having fun," Parker said. "Cops and robbers. Hide-and-seek, spies. I was always good at games like that when I was a kid. You just hang in there, my friend. And if you need help, I'll come, fast."
"I know," Dom said.
He walked back to the motel through a cold, damp wind. As in the hotel in Portland, he woke 3 times before dawn, always surfacing from an unremembered nightmare, always shouting about the moon. Tuesday, January 7th, Dom rose early and drove to Sacramento, then took Interstate 80 east toward Reno. Rain fell, silvery and cold for most of the drive, and by the time he reached the foothills of the Sierras, it was snowing. He stopped at an Arco station, bought tire chains, and put them on before heading into the mountains. The summer before last, he had taken more than 10 hours to get from Grants Pass to Reno, and this time the drive took even longer. When he finally checked in at Harris Hotel, where he had stayed before, called Parker Fane from a payphone, and had a bite of dinner in the coffee shop, he was too tired to do anything but pick up a copy of the Reno newspaper and return to his room. So at 8:30 that evening, sitting in bed in his underwear, he saw the story about Zebediah Lomac. Moon Man's Estate Worth $500,000. Reno. Zebediah Harold Lomac, 50, whose suicide on Christmas Day led to the discovery of his bizarre obsession with the moon, left an estate valued at more than $500,000. According to documents filed with the probate court by Eleanor Woolsey, sister of the deceased and executrix of Lomac's will, most of the funds are in accounts at various savings and loan associations and in treasury bills. The modest house in which Lomac lived at 1420 Wass Valley Road has an appraised value of only $35,000. Lomac, a professional gambler, is said to have amassed his wealth primarily from the game of poker. "He was one of the best players I ever knew," said Sidney Sierra Sid Garfork of Reno, another professional gambler and winner of last year's World Championship of Poker at Binion's Horseshoe Casino in Las Vegas. "He took to cards when he was just a kid the way some others might have a natural knack for baseball or math or physics." According to Garfork and other friends of Lomac, the gambler's estate would have been even larger if he had not had a weakness for dice games. "He lost back more than half his winnings at the craps tables, and the IRS took a big chunk, of course," Garfork said. On Christmas night, responding to a neighbor's report of shotgun fire, Reno police officers found Lomac's body in the garbage-strewn kitchen of his home. Upon further investigation, they found thousands of photographs of the moon decorating walls, ceilings, and furniture. There was more to the story, which had apparently been a local sensation for the past 2 weeks. Dom read with growing fascination and uneasiness. Most likely, Zebediah Lomac's mad obsession with the moon had nothing to do with Dom's own problems. Coincidence. Yet, he felt a stirring of precisely that fear, part terror, part horror, and part awe, that filled him when he woke from his nightmares, that also overwhelmed him when he went sleepwalking and tried to nail windows shut. He pored over the article several times, and at 9:15, in spite of his weariness, he decided that he had to get a look in the Lomac house. He dressed, retrieved his rented car from the hotel's valet parking, and got directions to Wass Valley Road from the attendant. Reno was below the snow line, so the night was dry and the roads clean. Dom stopped at an all-night Save-On drugstore to buy a flashlight. He arrived at 1420 Wass Valley Road shortly after 10 o'clock and parked across the street. The house was actually a bungalow with large porches, every bit as modest as the news account had indicated. It sat on a half-acre lot. From previous storms, snow lay in patches on the roof, covered the lawn, weighted the branches of several large pines. The windows were dark. According to the article in the Reno newspaper, Eleanor Woolsey, Zebediah Lomac's sister, had flown in from Florida 3 days after his death on December 28th. She arranged the funeral services, which had been conducted on the 30th, and was staying over until the estate was settled. However, she was at a hotel rather than in her brother's house, because the bungalow was too depressing. Dom was a law-abiding citizen. The prospect of breaking into the house gave him no thrill. But it had to be done, because there was no way he could see it except by forced entry. He saw no point in trying to persuade Eleanor Woolsey to allow a visit tomorrow, for she had been quoted in the newspaper as saying that she was sick and tired of gawkers, and that she was repulsed by the perverse curiosity of strangers. 5 minutes later, on the back porch of the Lomax bungalow, Don discovered that the door was equipped with a deadbolt in addition to its regular lock. He tried the windows that faced onto the porch. The one above the kitchen sink was unlatched. He slid it open and clambered inside. Hooding the flashlight with one hand to avoid drawing the notice of anyone outside, he swept the narrowed beam around the kitchen, which was no longer in the disgusting condition in which Reno policemen had found it on Christmas. According to the newspaper, just 2 days ago, Lomax's sister began cleaning the house and preparing it for sale. Evidently, she had started here. The garbage was gone, the counters were clean, and the floor was spotless. The air was filled with the stink of new paint and spectracide. A single, startled roach scurried along the baseboard and disappeared behind the refrigerator, but there was no longer a gross infestation, and there were no pictures of the moon. Don was suddenly worried that Eleanor Woolsey and her helpers might have made too much progress. Perhaps all traces of Zebediah Lomax's obsession had been stripped down, scrubbed out, and thrown away. But that concern was quickly put to rest when Dom followed the pale, probing beam of the flashlight into the living room, where the walls and ceiling and windows were still papered with big posters of the moon. It seemed as if he were hanging in deep space, in some crowded realm where 100 cratered worlds orbited impossibly close to one another. The effect was disorienting. He felt dizzy, and his mouth went dry. He moved slowly out of the living room into a hallway where hundreds of pictures of the moon, some color and some black and white, some large and some small, some overlapping others, had been fixed to every inch of the walls with glue, scotch tape, masking tape, and staples. The same decorations had been applied in both bedrooms as well, so the omnipresent moon seemed almost like a fungus that had spored and spread throughout the house, creeping into every corner. The newspaper report had said that no one but Lomax had been in the house for more than a year prior to his suicide. Don believed it, for if visitors had seen the work of this lunatic cut-and-paste Michelangelo, they would have contacted the mental health authorities at once. The neighbors told of the gambler's rapid metamorphosis from a hail fellow to a recluse. Apparently his fascination with the moon had begun the summer before last. The summer before last. The timing uncannily paralleled the changes in Dom's own life. Second by second, Dom grew more uneasy. He could not understand the insane behavior that had created this eerie display, could not put himself inside the fevered mind of Lomax, but he could empathize with the gambler's terror. Just moving through the moon-crowded house, shining his flashlight on the lunar faces, Dom felt a tingling along the back of his neck. The moons did not mesmerize him as they had evidently mesmerized Lomax, but as he stared at them, he sensed instinctively that the impulse that had driven Lomax to paper his house with moon images was the same impulse that drove Dom himself to dream of them. He and Lomax had shared some experience in which the moon had figured, or of which it was an apt and powerful symbol. The summer before last, they had been in the same place at the same time, the wrong place at the wrong time. Lomax had been driven mad by the stress of repressed memories. "Will I be driven mad, too?" Dom wondered, as he stood in the master bedroom, turning slowly in a circle. A new and grim thought struck him. Suppose Lomax had not killed himself out of despair over his unshakable obsession, but had instead been compelled to shove the shotgun barrel into his mouth, because he had finally remembered what had happened to him the summer before last. Maybe the memory was far worse than the mystery. Maybe, if the truth were revealed, sleepwalking and nightmares would seem less terrifying than what had happened during that drive from Portland to Mountain View.
moons. The oppressiveness of those pendulant forms drastically increased. The claustrophobic mural made breathing difficult. The moons seemed to portend some unreadable but manifestly evil fate that awaited him, and he stumbled out of the room, suddenly eager to flee from them. Among a herd of leaping and prancing shadows, whipped up by the bobbling beam of the flashlight, he ran down the short hall into the living room, tripped over a stack of books, and fell with a jarring crash. For a moment he lay stunned, but his senses swiftly cleared, and he was jolted to find himself staring at the word Dominic, which was scrawled in felt-tip pen across the luminous moon face in one of the dozens of identical big posters. He had not noticed it when he had come through from the kitchen earlier, but now he had fallen so that the flash in his right hand was aimed just right. A chill rippled through Dom. He had read nothing about this in the newspaper, but the handwriting surely belonged to Lomac. To the best of his knowledge, he had not known the gambler, yet to pretend that this was another Dominic would be to embrace an outrageous coincidence. He got up from the floor and took a couple of steps toward the poster that bore his name, stopping 6 feet from it. In the penumbra of the flashlight beam, he saw writing on an adjacent poster. His own name was only one of four that Lomac had scribbled across four lunar images. Dominic, Ginger, Fay, Ernie. If his name was here, because he had shared a forgotten, nightmarish experience with Lomac, then the other three must have been fellow sufferers as well, though Dom could remember nothing whatsoever about them. He thought of the priest in the Polaroid snapshot. Was that Ernie? And the blonde strapped to the bed. Was she Ginger? Or Fay? As he moved the light from one name to the other and back again, some dark and awesome memory did indeed stir in him. But it remained far down in his subconscious, an amorphous blur, like a giant ocean creature swimming past just below the mottled surface of a murky sea, its existence revealed only by the rippled wake of its passage and by the flicker of shadow and light in the water. He tried to reach out for the memory and seize it, but it dove deep and vanished. From the moment he had come into the Lomac place, Dom had been in the hands of fear. But now frustration took an even tighter grip on him. He shouted in the empty house, and his voice echoed coldly off the moon-papered walls. Why can't I remember? He knew why, of course. Someone had mucked with his mind, scrubbing out certain memories. But still he shouted, fearful, furious. Why can't I remember? I've got to remember! He held his left hand toward the poster that featured his name, as if to wrench from its substance the memory that had been in Lomac's mind when he had scrolled Dominic. His heart thumped. He roared with hot anger. God damn it! God damn you, whoever you are! I will remember! I will remember, you sons of bitches! You bastards! I will! Suddenly, impossibly, even though he was not touching it, though his hand was still a few feet from it, the poster bearing his name tore loose from the wall. It was fixed in place with four strips of masking tape angled across its corners, but the tape peeled up with the sound of zippers opening, and the poster leapt off the wall, as if a wind had blown straight through the lath and plaster behind it. With a rattle and rustle of paper wings, it swooped at him, and he staggered back across the living room in surprise, nearly falling over the books again. In his unsteady hand, his flashlight revealed that the poster had stopped a few feet from him. It hung at eye level, unsupported, in thin air, undulating slightly from top to bottom, first bulging out at him and then bending away when the direction of undulation reversed itself. As the pocked surface of that moon rippled, his own handwritten name fluttered and writhed as if it were the legend on a wind-stirred banner. Hallucination, he thought desperately. But he knew it was really happening. He could not breathe, as if the cold air were so syrup
thick with miraculous power that it could not be inhaled. The poster floated closer. His hands shook. The flashlight jiggled. Sharp glints of light lanced off the undulant surface of the glossy paper. After a timeless moment, in which the only sound was the crackle of the animated poster, other noise abruptly arose from every part of the room. The zipper sound of masking tape being pulled loose. On the ceiling, walls, and windows, the other posters simultaneously disengaged themselves. With a brittle clatter, rattle, whoosh, half a hundred moon images exploded toward Dom from every direction, and he cried out in surprise and fear. The loosed cry was like a blockage expelled from his windpipe, for he was suddenly able to breathe. The last of the tape pulled loose. 50 posters hung unmoving in midair, not even rippling, as if pasted firmly to nothing whatsoever. The silence in the dead gambler's house was as profound as in a temple devoid of worshippers, a cold and penetrating silence that seemed to pierce to the core of Dom, seeking to replace even the soft, liquid susurration of his blood's movement through his arteries and veins. Then, as if they were 50 parts of a single mechanism brought to life with the flick of a switch, the 3-by-5-foot lunar images shivered, rustled, flapped. Although there was not the slightest breeze to propel them, they began to whirl around the room in the orderly manner of horses on a carousel. Dom stood in the middle of that eerie merry-go-round, and the moon circled him. They capered and twirled, curled and uncurled, flexed and flapped, here seen as half-moons and here as crescents and here full face, and they waxed and waned, ascended and descended, faster, faster, faster still. In the flashlight glow it seemed like a procession set in motion by the sorcerer's apprentice, who, in the old story, had magically imparted life to a bunch of broomsticks. Dom's fear receded, making room for wonder. At the moment there seemed no threat in the phenomenon. In fact, a wild delight burgeoned in him. He could think of no explanation for what he was witnessing, but stood in dumb astonishment, puzzled and amazed. Usually nothing was so terrifying as the unknown, but perhaps he sensed a benign power at work. Wonderstruck, he turned slowly in a circle, watching the moons parade around him, and at last a tremulous laugh escaped him. In an instant the mood changed dramatically. In a cacophony of imitation wings, the posters flew at Dom as if they were 50 enormous and furious bats. They swooped and darted over his head, slapped his face, beat against his back. Though they were not alive, he attributed malevolent intent to their assault. He put one arm across his face and flailed at the moons with a hand that held a flashlight, but they did not fall back. The noise grew louder and more frantic as the paper wings beat on the chilly air and on one another. His previous delight forgotten, Dom stumbled across the room in a panic, searching for the way out, but he could see nothing but zooming, soaring, spinning moons, no doors, no windows. He staggered one way, then another, disoriented. The noise grew still worse, as in the hallways and other rooms of the bungalow, 1,000 moons began to tear free of their petrified orbits upon the walls. Tape pulled loose and staples popped out of plaster, and glue suddenly lost its adhesiveness. 1,000 cratered moon forms, and then 1,000 more, detached themselves and rose into suspension with 10,000 rustles, spun and swooped toward the living room with 100,000 clicks and crackles and hisses, swinging into orbit around Dom with a steadily swelling roar that sounded as if he were immersed in raging flames. The glossy, full-color pictures, torn from magazines and books, now flashed and sparkled and shimmered as they darted through the flashlight beam, contributing to the scintillant illusion of fire, and the black-and-white pictures cascaded down and spiraled up like bits of ash caught in thermal currents. Gasping for breath, he sucked in slick paper and newsprint moons and had to spit them out. Thousands of small paper whorls seethed around him in layer upon layer, and when he hysterically parted one curtain composed of false planetoids, there was only another behind it. Intuitively, he perceived that this impossible display was meant to help him break through to a full recollection of his unremembered nightmares. He had no idea who or what lay behind the phenomenon, but he sensed the purpose. If he immersed himself in the storm of moons and let them sweep him away, he'd understand his dreams, understand the frightening cause of them, and know what had happened to him on the road 18 months ago. But he was too scared to let go and be drawn into a trance by the mesmerizing weave and bobble of the pale spheres. He longed for that revelation, but was terrified of it. He said, "No! No!" He pressed his hands over his ears and squeezed his eyes shut. "Stop it! Stop it!" His heart hammered 2 beats to each exclamation. "Stop it!" His throat cracked as his cries broke loose. "Stop it!" He was astonished when the tumult was cut off with the suddenness of a symphony orchestra terminating a thunderous crescendo on one last bone-shaking note. He did not expect his shouted commands to be obeyed, and he still did not think his words had done the trick. He took his hands away from his ears. He opened his eyes. A galaxy full of moons hung around him. With a trembling hand, he plucked one of the pictures from its unsupported perch upon the air. Wonderingly, he turned it over in his hand, tested its substance between 2 fingers. There was nothing special about the picture, yet it had been suspended magically before him, just as thousands more were still suspended, motionless. "How?" he said shakily, as if the moons, being able to levitate, ought also to be able to speak. "How? Why?" The moons fell as one. As by the breaking of some spell, the thousands of pieces of paper dropped straight to the floor, where they lay in uneven heaps, in a drift, over Dom's winter boots with no lingering trace of the mysterious life force that had possessed them. Bewildered and half in shock, Dom shuffled toward the doorway that led to the hall. The moons crunched and rustled like dry autumn leaves. At the door he stopped and played his flashlight beam slowly over the short corridor, where not a single lunar image remained moored by staples, tape or glue. The walls had been stripped bare. Turning, he took a couple of steps into the center of the living room once more, then knelt among the debris. He put down the glowing flashlight and sifted paper moons through his trembling hands, trying to understand what he had seen. Within him, fear fought delighted amazement, and terror battled awe. But in truth he could not decide how he ought to feel, because there was no precedent for what he had experienced. One moment, a giddy laugh began to build, but then joy was frozen by a breath of cold horror. Now, he felt he'd been in the presence of something unspeakably evil, but now he was just as convinced it had been something good and pure. Evil, good, perhaps both, or neither. Just, well, something, some mysterious thing beyond the descriptive, definitive power of words. He knew one thing only. Whatever had happened to him the summer before last was far stranger than he had realized heretofore. Still sifting paper moons through his fingers, he noticed something unusual on his hands. He brought them palms up into the direct beam of the flashlight. Rings. On each palm blazed a ring of swollen red skin, each as perfect as if the inflamed tissues had conformed to a pattern drawn with a draftsman's compass. Even as he watched,
The stigmata faded, vanished. It was Tuesday, January 7th. 6. Chicago, Illinois. In his bedroom on the second floor of St. Bernadette's Rectory, Father Stefan Vikazic woke to the thump of a drum. The beat had the deep boom of a bass drum and the hollow reverberation of timpani. It sounded like the pounding of an enormous heart, although it embellished the simple two-stroke rhythm of the heart with an extra beat. Lub-dub-dub. 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 Bewildered and still half asleep, Stefan switched on the lamp, squinted in the blaze of light, and looked at his alarm clock. It was 2:07 Thursday morning. Certainly not a reasonable hour for a parade. Lub-dub-dub. Lub-dub-dub. After each triad of thumps, there was a 3-second pause, then a set of beats identical to all the others, then another 3-second pause. The precise timing and the unfaltering repetition of the noise began to seem less like the work of a drummer and more like the laborious piston stroke of an enormous machine. Father Vikazic threw back the covers and padded barefoot to the window that looked out on the courtyard between the rectory and the church. He saw only snow and bare-limbed trees in the backwash of the carriage lamp above the sacristy door. The beats grew louder, and the pause between the groups shortened to about 2 seconds. He took his robe from the back of a chair and slipped it on over his pajamas. The sonorous pounding was so loud now that it was no longer merely an annoyance and puzzlement. It had begun to frighten Stefan. Each burst of sound rattled the window panes and shook the door in its frame. He hurried into the upstairs hall. He fumbled in the dark for the wall switch and finally turned on the overhead light. Farther along the short hall, on the right, another door opened, and Father Michael Girano, Stefan's other curate, dashed out of his room, struggling into his own robe.
"What is that?"
"Don't know," Stefan said. The next triple thud was twice as loud as the group preceding it, and the entire house reverberated as if it had been struck by 3 gigantic hammers. It was not a hard, sharp sound, but muffled in spite of its loudness, as if the hammers were thinly padded yet swung with tremendous force. The lights flickered. Now the thumps were separated by no more than a second of silence, not long enough for the echo of the previous fulminations to fade away, and with each powerful hammering the lights flickered again, and the floor under Stefan trembled. In the same instant, Father Vikazic and Father Girano perceived the locus of the noise, Brendan Cronin's room. They moved swiftly to that door, which was directly across the hall from Father Girano. Incredibly, Brendan was fast asleep. In spite of the thunderous explosions that made Father Vikazic flash back to the mortar fire of Vietnam, Brendan dreamed on, untroubled. In fact, in the pulsing light there seemed to be a vague smile tugging at the young priest's lips. The windows rattled, drapery hooks clicked against the rods to which they were attached. On the dresser, a hairbrush bounced up and down and several coins clinked together, and Brendan's breviary slid first to the left and then to the right. On the wall above the bed, a crucifix jiggled wildly under the picture hook from which it was hung. Father Girano shouted, but Stefan could not hear what the curate said, for now there were no pauses between muffled detonations. With each tripartite beat, Father Vikazic retreated further from his initial mental image of a huge drum and became increasingly convinced that what he was hearing was the throbbing of some enormous and immeasurably powerful machine. But it seemed as if the sound came from all sides, as if the machinery was hidden within the walls of the house itself, laboring at some mysterious and unknowable task. As the breviary finally slid off the dresser and the coins began to spill to the floor, Father Girano backed to the doorway and stood there wide-eyed as if he might flee. But Stefan went to the bed, bent over the dozing priest, and shouted his name. When that had no effect, he grabbed Brendan by the shoulders and shook him. The auburn-haired curate blinked and opened his eyes. The hammering stopped abruptly. The sudden cessation of thunderous noise jolted Father Vikazic as badly as the first boom that had shattered his sleep.
He let go of Brendan and looked around the room, disbelieving.
I was so close,
Brendan said dreamily.
I wish you hadn't wakened me. I was so close.
Stefan pulled aside the covers, took hold of the curate's hands, and turned them palms up. There was an angry red ring in each palm. Stefan stared at them in fascination, for this was the first time that he had seen the stigmata.
What in God's name is this all about? He wondered.
Breathing hard, Father Gerano approached the bed. Staring at the rings, he said,
What are those from?
Ignoring the question, Father Vikasik spoke to Brendan. What was that sound? Where did it come from?
Calling,
Brendan said, in a voice still thick with sleep and with a soft, excited pleasure.
Calling me back.
What was calling you?
Stefan demanded. Brendan blinked, sat up, and leaned against the headboard. His eyes had been out of focus. Now his gaze cleared, and he really looked at Father Vikasik for the first time.
What happened? You heard it too?
Somehow. Yes, Stefan said. It shook the whole house. Amazing. What was it, Brendan?
A call. It was calling me. And I was following the call.
But what was calling you?
I don't know. Something. Calling me back.
Back where?
Brendan frowned.
Back into the light. The golden light of the dream I told you about.
What's this all about?
Father Gerano persisted. His voice was shaky, for he was not as accustomed to the miraculous as were his rector and his fellow curate.
Will somebody clue me in?
The other priests continued to ignore him. To Brendan, Stefan said, This golden light, what is it?
Could it have been God calling you back to his fold?
No, Brendan said, just something calling me back. Next time, maybe I'll get a better look at it.
Father Vikasik sat on the edge of the bed.
You think this will happen again?
You think it'll keep calling to you?
Yes, Brendan said. Oh, yes.
It was Thursday, January 9th. Seven, Las Vegas, Nevada. Friday afternoon, Georgia Monotella was at the casino working when she learned that her ex-husband, Alan Rykoff, had killed himself. The news came by way of an emergency telephone call from Pepper Carafield, the hooker with whom Alan had been living. Georgia took the call on one of the phones in the blackjack pit, cupping a hand over one ear to block out the roar of voices, the click and snap of cards being dealt and shuffled, the ringing of slot machines. When she heard that Alan was dead, she was shocked and sickened, but she felt no grief. By his own selfish and cruel behavior, Alan had ensured she would have no reason to grieve for him. Pity was the only emotion she could summon.
He shot himself this morning, 2 hours ago,
Pepper elaborated.
The police are here now. You've got to come.
The police want to see me?
Georgia said.
But why? No, no, the police don't want to see you. You got to come and clean his stuff out. I want his stuff out of here as soon as possible.
But I don't want his things,
Georgia said.
It's still your job, whether you want them or not. Miss Carafield, it was a bitter divorce. I neither want nor... He had a will drawn up last week. He named you executor, so you got to come. I want his stuff out of here now. It's your job.
Alan had lived with Pepper Carafield in a high-rise condominium, a ritzy place called The Pinnacle on Flamingo Road, where the call girl owned an apartment. It was a 15-story, white, concrete monolith with bronze windows. Surrounded by undeveloped desert land, it appeared to be even taller than it was, and because it stood alone, it looked oddly like a monument, the world's largest, swankiest tombstone. The grounds were lushly planted with sprinkler-tended lawns and flower beds, but a few dry tumbleweeds had blown in from the bordering plots of sand and scrub. The chill and desolate wind which stirred the tumbleweeds also fluted hollowly under the condominium's portico. Two police cars and a morgue wagon stood in front of the building, but no cops were in the lobby, just a young woman on a mauve sofa near the elevators 40 feet away, and at a desk near the entrance a man in gray slacks and blue blazer who was security guard and doorman. The travertine marble floor, crystal chandeliers, oriental carpet, Henry Don sofas and chairs and brass elevator doors contributed to a decor that strained too hard to convey class, but conveyed it nonetheless. As Georgia asked the doorman to announce her, the young woman on the sofa rose and said,
"Mrs. Rykoff, I'm Pepper Carafield. I think you use your maiden name now." "Monatella," Georgia said.
Like the building in which she lived, Pepper strained for Fifth Avenue class, but her efforts were less successful than those of the interior designers who had worked on the pinnacle. Her blonde hair had been cut in an excessively shaggy, carefree style that hookers preferred, perhaps because when you spent your workday in a series of beds, shaggy hair required less grooming. She wore a purple silk blouse that might have been a Halston, but she had left too many buttons open, revealing a daring amount of cleavage. Her gray slacks were well-tailored, but too tight. She wore a Cartier watch encrusted with diamonds, but the elegant effect of the watch was spoiled by her indulgence in flashy diamond rings. She wore 4 of them.
"I couldn't dare to stay upstairs in the apartment," Pepper said, motioning for Georgia to join her on the sofa. "I'm not going back up there until they've taken the body away."
She shivered.
"We can talk right here, just so we keep our voices low."
She nodded toward the doorman at the desk.
"But if there's going to be a scene, I'll just get up and walk away. You understand? People here don't know what I do for a living. I intend to keep it that way. I never do business out of my home. I'm strictly outcall."
Her gray-green eyes were flat. Georgia stared coldly at her.
"If you think I'm a scorned, suffering wife, you can relax, Miss Carafield. Anything I ever felt for Alan is gone now. Even knowing he's dead, I feel nothing. Nothing much. I'm not proud of it. I was in love with him once, and we created a lovely child together. I should feel something, and I'm ashamed that I don't. But I'm definitely not going to cause a scene."
"Oh, great,"
Pepper said, genuinely pleased, so involved with herself and her own concerns that she was oblivious of the domestic tragedy Georgia had just described.
"There are a lot of high-class people live here, you know. When they hear my boyfriend killed himself, they're going to be standoffish for a long time. These kind of people don't like messy scenes, and if they found out what I do for a living, well, there'd be no way I'd ever fit in here again, you know? I'd have to move, and I sure don't want to. No way, honey. I like it here. A lot."
Georgia looked at Pepper's ostentatiously diamond-encumbered hands, looked at her plunging neckline, looked into her avaricious eyes, and said,
"What do you suppose they think you are? An heiress?"
Astonishingly, missing the sarcasm, Pepper said,
"Yeah, how'd you know? I paid for the condo with $100 bills, so no credit check was necessary, and I've let them all think my family has money."
Georgia did not bother to explain that heiresses did not pay for condominiums with bundles of $100 bills. She simply said,
"Could we talk about Alan? What happened? What went wrong? I would never have thought Alan was a type to kill himself."
Glancing at the doorman to make sure he had not left his post and drifted nearer, Pepper said,
"Me neither, honey. I'd never have pegged him as the type. He was so macho. That's why I wanted him to move in and take care of me, manage me. He was strong, tough. Of course, a few months ago he started acting a little weird, and lately he was downright creepy. Weird and creepy enough that I was thinking about maybe finding someone else to look after me.
But I didn't expect he'd screw things up for me by killing himself. Christ, you just never know, do you?
Some people have no consideration,
Georgia said. She saw Pepper's eyes narrow, but before the hooker could say anything, Georgia said,
Am I to understand that Alan was pimping for you?
Pepper scowled.
Listen, I don't need a pimp. Whores need pimps. I'm no whore. Whores get $50 blowjobs, screw 8 or 10 Johns a day for whatever they can get, spend half their lives with the clap and wind up broke. That's not me, sister. I'm an escort for gentlemen of means. I'm on the approved escort list of the finest hotels, and last year I made $200,000. What do you think of that? I got investments. Whores don't have investments, honey. Alan wasn't my pimp. He was my manager. In fact, he managed a couple of my girlfriends, too. I fixed him up with them because, at first, before he started getting strange, he was the best.
Dazzled by the woman's self-delusion, Georgia said,
And Alan took a managerial fee for handling your career? And theirs?
Her scowl fading, somewhat placated by Georgia's willingness to use euphemisms, Pepper said,
No. That was one of the best things about our arrangement with him. He was still a blackjack dealer. See, that's where he made his money. He had all the contacts needed to manage us, but all he wanted for his trouble was free trade. I never knew a man who needed so much pussy. He couldn't get enough. In fact, the last couple of months he seemed obsessed with pussy. Was he like that with you, honey?
Repulsed by this sudden intimacy, Georgia tried to stop the woman. But Pepper would not be quiet.
In fact, the last few weeks he was so horny all the time that I started to think maybe I should dump him. I mean, there was something a little crazy about it. He'd do it and do it and do it until he just couldn't get his pecker up to do it anymore, and then he'd want to watch X-rated videotapes.
Georgia was suddenly angry that Alan had made her executor, forcing her to witness the moral squalor in which he had passed the last year of his life. And she was angry because she would have to find a way to explain his death to Marcy, who was already treading a psychological tightrope. But she was not really angry with Pepper Carrefield. Not angry, but appalled, yes, because even Alan deserved a little mourning and respect from his live-in lover, more than this shark could ever give him. But there was no point in blaming the shark for being a shark. One of the elevators opened, disgorging uniformed policemen, morgue employees, and a gurney bearing a corpse in an opaque plastic body bag. Georgia and Pepper rose from the sofa. Even as the stretcher was being rolled out of the first elevator, the doors of the second opened, and 4 more cops appeared, 2 in uniform, plus a team of plainclothes detectives. A detective came to Pepper Carrefield and asked a few final questions. No one asked any questions of Georgia. She stood rigid and suddenly numb, staring at the body bag that contained her ex-husband.